Welcome to the Future of Solar podcast with Vikram Kumar.
Now on our magic number, our 10th podcast. Today we have the absolute pleasure of having a very important person from the industry join us, Mr. Vince Barnes. So he's an electrical engineer, a solar and battery project developer, a musician, a very senior manager from the past, a giant called Wurzel, an ex-submariner. We've had someone from the Navy. We've had someone from the Army. Now we've got someone from the Navy. Vince, welcome.
Thank you very much, Vikram. I just hope I can live up to your big intro there. And it's always a pleasure to speak to you.
The feelings likewise, Vince. We didn't talk much about our backgrounds, and I think this is proving to be popular on our podcast. Can you tell us a bit about, like, Anthony Hopkins has a new advert available with Welcome to Wrexham, where he looks in the mirror and says, "Who are you?" And I find that quite chilling, you know. Who are you, Vince? Can you tell us about your early life growing up in Newcastle and your football and your rugby stuff?
Yeah, certainly. So I was born just outside of Newcastle, and in a little village, and I had a fairly normal upbringing, but I was one of those kids that when I was about 5 or 6, my mother was constantly having to come out and find me, which was always in the same place on the football field playing football with my mates. And I could play for 8, 9, 10 hours a day and not get tired. And when I went to the comprehensive, I was a goalkeeper and also a rugby player. And when I was 11, I think it was, and I used to play in goal, and I really loved it. It was, and I had a nickname at the time of Mick Mabini. My nickname was Bean because I was tall. Well, I wasn't tall. I was just very skinny. And there was a goalkeeper playing for Newcastle at the time called Mick Mahoney, and my nickname was Mick Mabini because I was a goalkeeper and I was tall, and my nickname was Bean. So that was my football side of things until I went into the Navy. But I was also, when I was 11 and 12, I used to play rugby. And I remember once we played a game against a local comprehensive called Bladen. And they had a massive guy who, I'm sure this guy wasn't 11 years old. He must have been about 15 or 16, but he was in the 11-year-old team. And he was the equivalent of Jonah Lumu when he destroyed England. And he just went through our defense like butter. And I hadn't actually had a run in with him. And then we were getting beat 42-0. And he came running, and he was running at me. And whereas everybody else was running away and not wanting to be plowed by him, I ran for him, and he kind of did a double take. And I, as he came closer to me, I left for his legs, his ankles, and he went flying right over my head and banged his head. And after that, he wouldn't go anywhere near me. And we ended up coming back. It was 42-22 or something, 42-23. We still lost, but it wasn't by such a significant margin. So that's my rugby career. I did sort of play rugby when I was in the Navy, but not as much as football.
So 42-0, it can only be rugby, right? Share with us more about this young rugby prodigy.
Well, I don't really know much about him. Yeah, sorry. I don't really know much about him. I just know that he was a huge. He was probably twice the height of me. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was 11 years old, I was one of the smallest in my class, and this guy was, you know, he was very big. I was a hooker, and he was just a giant running towards the team. And even the big guys on our team were afraid of him because he was, once he built up a momentum, challenging him, stopping him, you know, body to body, just wasn't working. He was just plowing through everybody. And I was small, and there was no way I was going to stand up to him and just say, "Come on," and have a go, because he would have walked right over me. And so I just went for his ankles, and, you know, finally, I fortunately made a good tackle, clipped his ankles together and he went flying over the top of me. Thankfully, he didn't land on me, otherwise I'd probably not be here today to tell the tale. But as I said, as a prodigy, I really don't know anything about him, just that he was big and fast. Just like John Alumu.
But it speaks a lot of your character because, you know, I'm a Sunday league coach for my son's under 13s, and often we come across a big guy who walks through the whole three team, and you know, you take the horse to the water, but you can't make it drink. And I very much live by that because, you know, some of the littlest boys, they impress you and just get stuck in. What inspired you to join the Navy at the age of 17, Vince? And how did your sporting interest continue during the Navy?
Well, it was the Navy was it's something that came about when I was 5 years old. I was on a little rowing boat in Scarborough with my parents, my brother and my sister. And it was a really windy day and the sea was up and we were chugging along in this. It was a rowing boat, but it had an engine on the back and we were chugging along. I don't know whose stupid idea it was to have a day out on a boat when it was pouring with rain and windy. But anyway, we went out on this boat and I was petrified. I won't deny it. I looked at the waves and they were twice the height of me. And I thought, this boat's never going to survive. But when we got back in, I thought, I'm never, ever going to be afraid like that again. And I determined then I was going to join the Navy. My stepfather at the time was in the Navy, and it was just something that I had in my mind. And I kind of took a little bit of a wobble when I was 13. I joined the Air Training Corps. I loved flying. I wanted to be a pilot. I went to do the pilot tests, and which are quite stringent, especially the medicals are a whole one-day test. And when I went in for it, everything was fine. You know, physically I was very fit. But the one thing that they said was, you have a slight astigmatism in your right eye. And this was at the age of about 15. And they offered me air crew. So I was signed up to go into the RAF as air crew when I was 17. But I wasn't really passionate about it. And then one day I happened to be in Newcastle, in town with some friends, and we had a few beers, and we came out of Yates Wine Lodge, and right across the road from Yates Wine Lodge, which is opposite Central Station, it's not there now, but it was the Royal Naval Recruiting Office, and I thought, oh, would be a good idea to go in and you know, see if I can join the Navy. So I went in, and they literally nearly dragged me off the street and said, yeah, come in. I signed some forms. I went away, and I had to go back and do some assessments and everything. But the funny thing is, when I was when I went back home to my mum's house, and bearing in mind she'd already signed the forms for the RAF, and so she was of the opinion I was going to join the RAF, and I walked in and I said, Mum, you need to sign these forms for me. And she went, but I've already signed them. I said, no, this is for the Navy. And she went ashen white. And I said, what's the matter? She said, my friend Barbara, who was a clairvoyant, she read tea leaves. She called my mum up and said, is your Vince going to join the forces? And she said, yeah, he's joining the RAF. And she said, no, I'm seeing a dark uniform. And like I said, 5 minutes later, after she had that call, I walked in and said, I'm wanting to join the Navy. So it was kind of a long thing, but I'd always wanted to join the Navy. And then eventually, you know, as luck would have it, I joined in January the 2nd, 1982. And I remember leaving Newcastle train station at 8:15, and my family were on the platform. My mum was crying her eyes out. My brother and sister were going, go on, get away. and I ended up in Plymouth in HMS Fiskard at, I think it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on January the 2nd, 1982.
Well, it's interesting that you've got experience in energy and in the Navy, and you had some thoughts about the RAF. As I said earlier, we've had an army man on board with the podcast, and you know, we are in the middle of an energy war. The Department of Defense, they are complaining about the army, the navy, everything's shrinking, and we need to get into a war footing, which is quite frightening for me. But you know, what's new is because of remote working, it's very difficult for us to get to know our colleagues and to build a chemistry which is essential for successful work. How did you earn the name the Cat Vince?
Well, that was so. As I said, I used to be a goalkeeper, and when I joined the Navy, I signed up to the so where I was, it was at HMS Fiskard. There were six divisions, and each division had a football team, and I happened to be, and we had two teams. I happened to be the goalkeeper for my division, and we were playing. We did this knockout competition where the divisions were split east side and west side. There were three divisions on east side, three divisions west side, and it's kind of like the Champions League where everybody on each side on like the east side plays each other and home and away, even though it's the same football pitch. And then everybody on the west side plays each other home and away, and whoever's the top of each division, if you like, played each other. And so I was in goal in the final, and their team was absolutely all over us. I was probably one of the busiest goalkeepers ever. Every 30 seconds I was making a save, and there was one particular the attacker was one attack where the attacker was coming in. He got through our defense, and there was only me and him and one defender. The defender ran out. He took a shot, and I was at one side of the goal. He bent the ball round to the other side of the goal, and I literally stretched right across the goal and tipped it round the post. Now, on that particular post was the divisional officer from the opposite team, and he literally jumped on the pitch because he thought it was a goal. He jumped on the pitch and started going, "Yeah!" And the referee told him to get off the pitch, and there was the ball in my hand, and he said, "How on earth did you ever get to that ball? That was a dead-on goal." And from there on, I was nicknamed the Cat. Nothing
fantastic
to do with the animal itself.
You know, and the Navy is—it's a big highlight on your profile. Did you say in the past you were in charge of a nuclear weapons submarine? Is it? Did I remember that right?
Yeah. So I ended up being in charge of the missile control center on Polaris submarines, and that is effectively the computer systems, and I say computer systems with tongue in cheek because the memory storage on this huge computer system, which took a room about the size of an average sized living room, was 16 kilobytes. that was the storage space, and so I was in charge of the missile control center. That's you know, it was the system that made sure the weapons got to wherever they were going to go. But the funny thing and the ironic thing is, I used to write poetry a lot. I now write songs, and when I was 13, I wrote a song called "Smoke Without Flame." And it was a protest song about nuclear weapons, and specifically about the Polaris nuclear weapon system. And at 23, there I was in charge of the Polaris nuclear weapon system. How ironic, eh?
And on build up to this call, you said you hardly come across submariners. What is a submariner? I think you said it's as prestigious as being a fighter plane pilot in the RAF, right?
Yeah. So as a submariner, you get let me explain. In the Marine, Navy, sorry, there is two types of vessel. There's a ship and there's a target. Ship being a submarine and a target being a what you would call something that floats on the surface. And a submarine is just a long oblong tube which carries missiles or torpedoes, and it goes under the water. Now, on the submarines I was on, they were underwater for up to 3 or 4 months. The earlier submarines, the old diesel submarines, they would be underwater for about 24 hours and had to come up to, not to the surface, but just below the surface and recharge their batteries. But we were nuclear. We had a nuclear reactor on board, and so we could stay down. The only thing that meant we had to come up was running out of food, running out of food, and the crew not wanting to kill each other. So that was otherwise the Polaris weapon system, if it was all automated, would be able to patrol forever and a day. So I guess in relation to your question. Sorry, go on.
Mm-hmm. Please finish and then lead us to why you left the Navy. You're in charge of all this exciting stuff. Why would you leave?
Sure. Well, to finish off the question before, what's a submariner? So the difference between surface fleet and submarine fleet is, on surface fleet, you need to know a little bit about every compartment. When you join, you spend the day on each compartment just getting to know it. When you're on submarines, you spend between 3 and 6 months in doing what's called your part three. And that means you have to know every single sea valve, every air valve, every hydraulic valve, every system for shutdown, how to shut down the door in the event of emergency, how to fight fires in the event of emergency, which isn't just a fire extinguisher. It could be having to initiate the firefighting, the dry powder stuff or whatever in the compartment, which meant you had to get out of that compartment as well. So you had to know everything about that compartment in case something happened, a missile hit the compartment and it blew up, and you happened to be walking by or wherever, and the people in the compartment were dead. You had to be able to shut it down. You had to be able to fight the fire remotely or internally. And so you, at the end of your three months or however long it takes, part three, you get an exam, which is a walkthrough, and you go with one of the officers and walk through from aft to forward or forward to aft, and they will walk through with you and ask you a question. How do you shut down? There's been a hydraulic leak. How do you shut it down? Tell me about a hydraulic leak. What's the dangers? What can happen? And all that kind of thing. So when you finish your part three, you get what's called your dolphins. And in true naval tradition, you stand up in captain's table. He calls you forward, congratulates you, and he gives you dolphins in a tot of rum. And you're not allowed to pick the dolphins out. You have to catch them in your teeth while you're drinking the rum. And I nearly swallowed the damn things.
the dolphins, it's an insignia, kind of medal you get when you've learned everything about the submarine and qualified as a submariner, right?
Yeah, so if you imagine a pilot gets his wings and he sews it onto his jacket, a submariner gets his dolphins, but these were like a gold badge that you put on your uniform. And it's the same in every navy throughout the world. Submariners get the dolphins. And it's quite unique because I've met a number of submariners when I was in the Navy and just after when I was in the oil industry, I met a number of submariners. And there's a great amount of respect for each other. It doesn't matter what Navy you were in. I met a Russian submariner once, and I met a couple of French submariners when I was in Belgium. And it's like, oh, you're a submariner. Yes. Oh, that's fantastic. You know, it doesn't matter the Navy. They all have to go through the same thing. So they all know that that you've gone through what they've gone through. And it's like, you know, I take my hat off to you, sir. You've become a submariner, and that's great. So there's a big camaraderie between submariners around the world. Everybody has the respect of each other, which is a good thing, I think.
And do you still have your dolphins?
I probably have. They're probably at my mum's house, to be honest. Because when I left the Navy, I left everything at my mum's house, and she's probably still got them there.
So I'll be coming to your birthday, so hopefully we'll get to see them then. And then why would you leave this exciting environment to go join the oil and gas industry? You mentioned to me in the past you did hydrographic survey engineering. What is a hydrographic survey? And why did you leave the Navy?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. A hydrographic survey engineer is just somebody who who is an engineer who sets up, installs equipment on, say, a lay barge or a tug, and we will do sonar scanning of the seabed to find routes through for gas pipelines or oil pipelines. Or if we're laying a pipeline, then we'll be on a pipe lay barge, and I'll be in charge of the navigation equipment to make sure that the pipeline is laid in exactly where it's meant to be laid. So that's what a hydrographic survey engineer is. Why did I leave the Navy? Well, basically because it put me in submarines, and I joined the Navy to see the world, and I wasn't getting to see the world. So after I was in the Navy for 9 years, I was 4 years on submarines, 5 years as an apprentice, and I was on surface ships for about a year and a half in that time. And I just thought, this isn't for me. It, you know, going down and coming back up was 3 months later wasn't a fun experience. I wanted to go out and you know, have a girl in every port, drink beer with friends and new friends that I'd make in ports and stuff. And I wasn't doing that. So in the end, I decided to leave. And the funny thing is, when I went to leave, the captain, and I remember this guy for the rest of my life. He's a guy called Peter Christmas, Commander Peter Christmas. And he was a lovely guy, really lovely gentleman. And, you know, he knew there was 140 crew members on board the submarine, and he knew the name of every single one of them. So that tells you the kind of guy he is. And when I went to the captain's table to put my leave in, my request in to leave the Navy, he said, "Why do you want to leave the Navy?" And I said, "Well, I joined the Navy to see the world, sir, and I'm not getting to see it." And he laughed and he said, "Well, the next time we go on patrol, why don't you come up to the control room and I'll put the periscope up for you?" And I said, "That's not quite the view of the world that I had in mind, to be honest."
But isn't it ironic? Was the submarine docked, or was it actually sailing for 3 months under the oceans and the seas, and you were actually traveling around the world but not actually seeing it? Did I understand that well?
Yeah, we were traveling around. We were going thousands and thousands of miles, but I wasn't actually getting to. All I saw was the internal of the submarine. And another story to share is when I first went on patrol, or when I first went, before you go on patrol, you do what's called a test. So you spend a week at sea, and it's fire, flood, and famine. And they drill you from like 6 a.m. until midnight. When we were heading out and we were about to dive for the first time, we have to do a deep dive pressure test. And you go down to a certain depth, and you know, you stay there for about 5 minutes. And if anything's going to leak, it's going to leak then, because you're going down about three times the depth that you would normally go if you were operational. And what the so I was in the missile control center, and what they had was a piece of string. One of my colleagues had put a piece of string from bulkhead to bulkhead, and as we went down and got to the test depth, the string was actually on the floor. So the pressure on the submarine was that much that it gone down about a meter and maybe 1.2 meters to the floor. And then they fastened it again while we were down there. And as we were coming up, at some point the string just broke. And that was a very graphic demonstration for me of how much pressure there is under the water. It's quite incredible.
Absolutely. And now we've got offshore wind and submarine cabling, so I won't get into that now, but I understand you want to see the world. You know, believe it or not, our podcast has been listened to now in almost 50 countries. Half of it in the UK, the rest around the world, and I don't consider that as seeing the world either. We need to go out and see people. I've been out to Switzerland with you and Mr. Steve Ford in the past. You probably don't remember because there was so much going on at work at the time.
I remember.
And how did your? I'm surprised you do, because we had a few beers. But how did your journey into renewable energy begin? whilst living in Spain? How did you end up in Spain, and how did your involvement with solar projects start then?
So I was, once I left the Navy, I joined the oil and gas industry. I was in there for about 4.5 years. And because of my naval background, I was in the very highly in demand. And so I was always going offshore, because I used to get the job done. I used to, if equipment was broken, I would fix it because I'm a logical thinker. And so I used to think logically, and I would get I would get the fault repaired very quickly. And because of that, I was initially sent out to areas where they were having problems from the ship that I was on to go and fix somebody else's problems. And then in the end, I just didn't get home. And I just said, the only way I'm going to get out of this is by leaving the oil industry. And I went into IT. And so I used to do software development. When I was working in the oil industry, just for fun and giggles, I wrote a piece of software that was a mapping software. And this is all in Visual Basic, by the way, Visual Basic 1. It was a mapping software which took datums from WG184 and the clock datum, and was able to map where we were on the ship. Exactly where we were, just like the software that we were using, but it took me about 3 days to develop it. Actually, it took me about a day and a half to develop it and a day and a half to find a comma in the wrong place. So when I came out of the oil industry, I went into IT. And when I, in 2002, I think it was, I moved to Spain, and I maintain my thing in IT, and at the time the internet was a big thing. We just had the dot-com boom and bubble, the dot-com bubble and bust. And so I was developing websites, I was developing back-end systems, and I ended up in the village I was working in, or living in, sorry, a little place called Playa de Piles in the Valencia region. There was an estate agent, and I got to meet one of the girls from the estate agent. She found out what I did, and she said, "Why don't you come along on Monday, and we might have some work for you." So I went along, and they had their IT was terrible, and I just said, "You need to solve this." And the next day I came in, I'd written them a database to make their production of the leaflets I put out in the window easier, because I saw this girl trying to do it. It took her 25 minutes to put something together in Word and rearrange it and then print it off. And so I created an Access database and said, "Use this instead." It took about 2 minutes. And then I started doing that for other estate agents. And then eventually I went to PHP and SQL. And did it on websites and et cetera, et cetera. And then through that, I became so this was an estate agent, and a friend of mine wanted to buy a house. And so she came over, and I sat down with her for about an hour and a half, asked her what she wanted. The next day I went back to the office. I brought three or four properties, the details of three or four properties, and put the one that I thought she would go for on the top, and she loved it. And when she bought it, the guy from the estate agency give me 1500 euros. And I was like, "What's this for?" He said, "For selling a house." And I went, "That's more than you've paid me in the past month." I'm going to change careers. So I became not an estate agent. I was more of a buyer's agent and a property developer out there. And then from that, this was in 2002, 2003. In 2006, I was working for myself as a buyer's agent, and I met a guy out there who was looking for a large plot of land. Oh, sorry, 1,500 square meter plot of land with the permission to build 200 square meters. So I showed him a few, and he wasn't very happy because the prices were very expensive. And I said, "Well, you're better off actually going for 10,000 square meters of rustic land, because if it's over 10,000 square meters, you can build a 2 meter house and you can just fence off 1,500 meters."
This is your friend DJ, right?
This is
Mr.
Correct.
DJ Bruins,
yes,
right?
DJ Bruins. So it was DJ Bruins looking for his uncle, and he mentioned, oh, I can put in the other 8,500 square meters, I can put a solar park in. And I went, what on earth a solar park? And so he told me. I got interested. We kept in contact, and then, you know, I did some marketing collateral for him and a few other little bits and pieces. And one day he called me up and said, what are you doing for the next few months? And I said, well, I've just sold three houses. It's coming into summer. I haven't had a summer off since I've been in Spain, so I'm going to take the summer off. He went, no, you're not. I need your help. We've just lost a £20 million sale on one of our projects because our documentation was rubbish, and I need somebody who's diligent, who can speak English and put the documentation together. So I went in. Within about a week or so, I'd done what he'd asked me to do, and I was about to leave. And I said, by the way, what I've noticed from being here for the week is that you have the guys in the warehouse and the guys, well, mainly the girls in the front office, have no idea what each other does, and they're all, it's like they're all in different compartments, and they don't even know what each other does. And at least on a submarine, we might have been in compartments, but everybody knew what everybody else did. And I think the pace of growth that you've got at the moment, and he was growing rapidly. When I first met him, he had two employees working for him. When I started working for him, he had about 20 working for him. And this was in the space of a year. And, you know, I said, the pace of growth that you've got now, you're going to be in big, big problems if you don't sort it out. And so he asked me to come on board as a commercial director, which I did. And I stayed in Spain working with DJ until 2009. And then in September 2008, the Spanish government removed all of the capacity. The feed-in tariff went down from, I think it was 32 cents to some ridiculous amount. But worse still, they limited the capacity that could be installed in 2009 to 400 megawatts. And bearing in mind that in September 2008, they just installed 3 gigawatts in 1 month. So it gives you an indication as to how they destroyed the market literally overnight. And, you know, in 2009, I left DJ's employ because the company wasn't doing very well. So we agreed to part our ways. And I was working pretty much for myself doing rooftop installations. And then after that, I came back to the UK in 2010. And the funny thing is, before I came back to the UK, I was thinking about it anyway, because finding work in Spain at the time was very difficult. The crisis really, really hit hard. And I had a look at the UK just out of curiosity if it was viable in the UK, you know, with the irradiation, etc. And I found an announcement that Gordon Brown was going to introduce a feed-in tariff at the end of 2009. And this was just before then. And I thought, and it was 32p, I think it was. And I thought, wow, I did some quick numbers. And I thought, yeah, that would work. Who knew solar would work in the UK? So I think it was May the 1st, 2010. I jumped on a plane and came back to the UK, stayed with my brother. And I was only going to stay for 2 weeks and just decide what I wanted to do. And within 24 hours, I decided I was staying back in the UK again. So that's how I came back to the UK.
Well, a lot of people I know in solar suffer from burnout or anxiety of some kind because it's a boom and bust sort of industry. Things change all the time. People get very excited and things deflate. And then if you win a job, it becomes all work, work, work. And in your case, it seems like it wasn't all bad in the Navy. I did a bit of research before this podcast. Were you on HMS Ajax? Did you get to go out to see Antarctica? And how did your musical interest developed? Was this during Spain when you wrote your album Step Into the Sunlight?
No. So HMS Ajax was the ship I was on during my apprenticeship, and we went down to the Falklands, and it was a great experience. And one of my most poignant moments was going to the subantarctic and seeing an iceberg at close quarters. And I have a photograph of it. It was only a small one. You know, it looked like it was popping its head out. And it looked like you could almost reach out and touch it, but it was actually, it was about 3.5 miles away. And there was a massive ice wall, which again looked as if it was about 5-6 miles away, but it was 20 odd miles away. It was that big. It was popping up well above the sea level. But my favorite experience and all of that was I was walking along the beach at Grytviken. There was a whole bunch of us had gone ashore in a whaler just for a bit of giggles. And as we were walking along the beach, and bearing in mind it was minus 15, there was three penguins came out of the sea. And they were about 10 meters from us. And they started walking towards us as if to say, hey, get off my land, you. And I found it quite incredible. And I took my camera out and I started walking towards these penguins and they all turned away and they were waddling down to the water. But when they hit the water, they were like torpedoes. They just shot through that water. Anyway, one of them came back. He was obviously very curious. And when I took my photograph out, my camera out again, I started walking towards him and I have this brilliant photograph of him. And it's like he's flying on the beach. His wings are spread out and he's running down as fast as his feet could carry him. And it's one of my most treasured moments. I will probably never experience meeting a penguin in its natural habitat ever again. And it was just incredible that the scenery was breathtaking. There was a mountain drop behind us. There was icebergs all around us, and it just incredible, the most amazing experience.
Fantastic. So it's football polluting my brain. It's not HMS Ajax, it's HMS Ajax. yes. And your musical interests, did that start in the UK later on, or experience of performing live?
Yeah, I mean, when I was on the submarine, I was playing. We had a band on the submarine, and which isn't a very good thing because you make a lot of noise on the submarine; it can be heard for miles to listening sonar. But we were in safe places, so we could play, and I really enjoyed it. I used to play bass at the time, and we went away on one trip, and I bought this Tascam Porter Studio, which meant I could record four tracks onto a cassette tape. Remember them? Probably if there's anybody younger than 40 thinking, what on earth is a cassette tape? But anyway, so I started writing songs, and I wrote one which I actually released in 2017, but I wrote it in 1988. And it was when we were meant to be coming home for Christmas, and we got told that we were going to be staying out for 2 extra weeks. So I wrote this song, and it was kind of an angry song. And then all of a sudden we were told that we were actually coming in 5 days' time, just in time for Christmas. And I wrote the song called I'll Be Home for Christmas Day. So I've always written poetry or songs since I was about 11, 12. I've just had a fascination with rhyme and with words. And whilst I was in the Navy, I wrote quite a few songs. I probably had about 150, some of which I got recorded, but most of them I didn't. And over the years, I've kind of, you know, written songs, but just before I moved out to Spain, there was a friend of mine who we went out to the local pub, and the local pub were doing something called an open mic. Well, I'd never come across an open mic night before, and you know, this guy was up there and his girlfriend was going around asking everybody if they played. And I was just shrinking to the bar and drinking my beer. And my mate turned around and said, yeah, he does. He plays music. He's got, he writes and sings. And I'm going, no, I don't. Nobody wants to listen to my music. They all want to listen to covers. Anyway, she persuaded me to get up and play. And I was with a group of friends and, you know, I got up and played a couple of my songs. And the response was incredible. I don't know whether it was because we were friends and they were just, you know, being supportive, but the rest of the audience as well started clapping. And this was just before I went out to Spain. When I went out to Spain in 2002, where my apartment was, there was a bar right in front of me. And I got to know the owner very, very well, probably through spending all my waking hours in there when I wasn't working. And there was on my birthday, which is in May, I'd invited a few people over from the UK and was a few, you know, I had a bit of family there and a few people, a few friends that I'd made. And so I had this birthday party on my terrace, which was a quite a big terrace. In my apartment, and so I had all my music gear set up and I played live, you know, just me and my guitar, and the guy across the bar from the other, Francois, was standing outside the bar listening. And when I'd finished and put everything away and everything, and next day I went down to the pub, and he said, why don't you play in here? I'm like, oh no, I only know those 10 songs. He said, it doesn't matter. Come down on Friday and play. So I went down on the Friday and I played the 10 songs that I knew twice, because otherwise it would have been a very short concert. And this guy came up to me and said, do you know the Beatles' Let It Be? And I said, I don't know it now, but if you come back on next Friday, I'll learn it for you. And then a couple of other people asked for songs as well. So I did those three and I learned a couple more. So I did 15. Repeated them twice, so I was playing for 2 and a bit hours, and they were enamored with it because I'd actually taken the time to learn the songs and played for them their favorite songs, and it kept building up like that. And then in, I think it was in 2006, 2007, I wrote this song called Dance With Me, which you've heard played live, by the way. And
I have a tea, coffee or something it was.
No, Take Off Your Something was a lot later. Dance With Me was the first song that I ever had properly professionally recorded. And it was, there was a local radio station in near where I lived, in a place called Javier, called Coast FM. And there was a guy on there called Bob James. And I cheekily sent this letter to him saying, I'm the man sitting in the bins outside knocking on your window when it's cold. And But I'm also launching a single called Dance With Me. And he got back in touch with me. He phoned me up and said, have you spoken to anybody else about this? And I was like, no. He said, so we've effectively got a world exclusive. I said, well, you're the only other person in the world that knows about it apart from me and my family. And so he listened to it. He was brilliant for about a whole week. He was going to launch it on this Wednesday afternoon between 2 and 3. And for the whole week leading up to it, he had all his listeners enthralled in it, you know, all wanting to listen to Dance With Me. And he kept saying, don't forget, we've got a world exclusive on Wednesday, local artist. And I used to call myself the extranjero, which means the foreigner or the stranger in Spanish. And so he was announcing this and you know, it was brilliant that there was people in the area who were listening to it, but it was also probably one of the first live streamings done, certainly then at the time in 2006, 2007. And I sent this song to my sister, and my niece at the time was about 6-7 months old, and she had a baby bouncer in the doorway, and my sister was playing Dance With Me in the background, and she sent me a link on YouTube. I didn't even know what YouTube was at the time. And so I listened to it, and I saw Jasmine bobbing up and down in a baby bouncer and to Dance With Me. And to this day, and the last time I seen Jasmine was about a week ago when I was down south, and she told me then that in spite of all of Taylor Swift and Harry Styles and Bruno Mars that she was into at the time, that her favorite song of all time is Dance With Me, which I'm really pleased with, really, really chuffed with. So after
fantastic.
That,
sorry,
go on.
You've got, so if I manage to keep up a bit, I think I heard you say you wrote 150 songs in the Navy. You're a goldmine of creativity. I was referring to Tea Coffee something as a gig that you did for homeless shelters in Portsmouth. Yeah. So I did hear a few of your songs then. And then please finish on your music, and if you've got links, please share with me, and I'll include in your podcast description. which will be on the Future of Solar Photovoltaic website. And, you know, the amount of people I've seen crash and burn and have a burnout, you know, it's important to have a hobby. It's important to do something else outside of work. So please finish your train of thought on music and then moving into smart energy solutions. I would like to talk to you about that as well.
Okay. So I'll make it very quick. So I decided, as I said, I was going to move back to England from Spain in 2010. And part of that was part of the driver for that was the music, because I was playing in a band in Spain, and the musicians were very flaky. And I thought, this can't be the same in England. So I'm definitely going to move back to England, and it'll be much easier there. So when I went back to England, I had this drive for I have a dream, and that's literally the name of a song that I wrote as well. And it started in 1994 when I went to see the Eagles live on stage, and I was looking at the crowd, and it was very eclectic. There was an old lady beside me and her granddaughter. There was a couple of yuppies. There was loads and loads of hippies. There was people just like me dressed in jeans and t-shirt. There was every kind of person from every walk of life. And they started when the band were playing, it was great. Everybody was singing. It was just, you know, enjoying themselves. And then they started playing Lying Eyes. And as soon as the words started, it was like everybody had been told by somebody that you have to sing along to it, because the whole stadium, and this was at Wembley, just sang to Lying Eyes. And at the time, that was one of my favorite songs. It brought the hairs up on the back of my neck. And I just thought, this must be the most amazing experience as a songwriter to you know, sing their songs in front of an audience. And so that was when my dream was born. And that's what I was following when you saw us in 2017. Tea Coffee or Something was written in 2016. And it was a guy that I met on the street, and he asked me if I had any change, which I didn't. And it was 10:45 at night. And I said, but, you know, he was sitting outside of Sainsbury's. I said, I'll buy you a tea or a coffee or something. And he said, oh, if you wouldn't mind, I'll have a sandwich and a pint of milk. So I did. I sat down with them on the street. It was, I think it was February. It was freezing cold. But, you know, I thought, well, if he can hack it, so can I. So I sat down and talked with him for half an hour. Started bumping into him for quite a lot. And we became friends. He became a friend of the band. He became a bit of a roadie. Helping us out every now and again, and he loved coming to the studio watching us play. And then I tried to do something for homeless people. I wanted to do something and make a difference, and tried to get him off the street, but he'd been on so long that he just wasn't interested. And that's what I found with a lot of homeless people who'd been on the streets for a long time, that they don't really know how to cope with the real world, or with their real world is a lot different to ours, obviously. And so I'd written this song about him, and I got it recorded, and it was on May the 5th. My birthday seems to come up quite a lot here, doesn't it? Anyway, May the 5th in 2017.
May the 5th be with you.
We played in Portsmouth Guildhall, and you and I think it was your brother, your wife, and David and from DK Cables and his wife and a couple of others. Booked a table, and we raised I think about £2,500 for which we donated to the Pompey bus, which was a bus which was given by Go Ahead, and it was being reformed, and people were donating the time, they were donating materials and donating money to you know, get this bus up and running. And about, I think it was about 3 months after that, it was donated to a local charity. One fully done with enough beds for 10 people. So I did get into the homeless thing for a while, and you know, we ended up going to a hostel as a band, and we'd organize it with the owners of the hostel that we could come in, and we just did a bit of a concert. And what happened was, the people that were there was only about 10 of them in the common room. And we were only playing acoustically, but they all wanted to play. They all had some musical talent. So I said, yeah, no worries. Just want to play the guitar, do you want to play bass, drums, whatever. And it was a bit of a mishmash, but it was really good fun. And so I spoke to the the organizers and said, you know, there might be an opportunity here to help homeless people through music. Why don't we see put out a an appeal and see if anybody's got any instruments or don't want? Well, we had enough instruments at full, like a full PA system and everything, drum kits, the whole works. We had enough instruments to basically do two bands. People were so generous, and we donated it to this hostel. And you know, we went down a few times to do some jam sessions to get them up and running. And then after that, we did the second concert in December of 2017. So that's really my story with music. In 2018, I'd become jaded with the band, and you know, I think it was we launched the album Step Into the Sunlight on June the 30th, 2018, and I disbanded the band in July 2018, and I haven't really done anything since until now.
Wow! So 2017 was an important year because 2016 we had the Brexit referendum and all this uncertainty started. Before 2017, we had more work than we had capacity. We were forecasting huge growth in 2017, and they all just completely crashed. The chap that paid for this half of this table in your gig in Portsmouth, his name was Ross Kenway. His brothers were the firefighter, Mark Kenway, who worked with him as well. Those two brothers, they make leads for Henry Hoover's at Vacumatic. Very nice bunch of lads. Lots of things we can't talk about because of the crash and burn nature of the industry. And then your involvement with DJ Bruins, it seems like it carried on potentially with Risen Energy and Smart Energy Solutions, or SES, which you mentioned in the past you grew to massive turnover in a short period of time. Are you able to delve a bit more into that?
Yeah, sure. So when I came back to the UK, originally I was working with a company in Valencia who, when I moved to the UK, they wanted to explore the UK market. But within about 3 or 4 months, it was obvious that they didn't really have the money to invest. So I went on the MCS database. I sent out 25 emails to people, to companies on the MCS database, just saying, would you like more clients? I've got a business model that can help expand your business rapidly. And I had 10 responses to it within about 20 minutes. One of them was SES. There was five others who wanted me to come in for an interview, but SES impressed me because there was three directors, Mark, Paul, and Philip, and they were we were sitting in the boardroom. It was a Regis kind of office, but we were sitting in the boardroom having a conversation, and I produced this 3-page business plan and said, basically, that in the UK everybody's going down to Cornwall, but what everybody doesn't seem to realise is an irradiation study has been done before. And if you look at where they put, and it was done by the Victorians, and if you look at where they put seaside towns, that's where the highest irradiation is. So that's where you want to be focusing. And strangely enough, Hull was one of the highest irradiation in the country, outside of Cornwall and in the south coast. But nobody thought about Hull because it's always wet and miserable. And yet there is. Nearly a gigawatt of solar being developed and built in Hull. Anyway, so I, after doing this, you know, Paul said to me, he actually said to Mark and Philip, close the door and don't let him get out until he signed the contract. Jokingly, thankfully. So I started working for them. And at the time, they were only, I think they turned over £500,000 in the year before. And so I joined them in November, I think it was November the 10th, 2011. And in June, so the timeline was on June 28th, I'd met a guy called Aaron Mowbray, who was him and his business partners from a company called MO3. So it was basically three guys named M, or named Mo. And they were, they had this project for sale. And as you know, in July the 31st, 2012 was when the feed-in tariff went down from 32p to 8.5p. And they had this this site, which was effectively worthless because nobody wanted to buy it. It was only 4 weeks away from the feed-in tariff end. And Paul Hunter, I went to see him and said, there's an opportunity here if we can act quick. And he said, okay, no worries, let's do it. So, and in the meantime, by the way, DJ had come on board with SES. So I called up DJ. He'd been working in Italy. And I said, there's an opportunity here. You know, they're looking at distribution and all sorts of things. And this is right up your street. So he came over and we were all sitting around the table. And I said to DJ, can we build it? Yes, we can. And so we DJ and I spent 7 nights speaking to Risen. Nights because they were in China and they started at midnight our time and went to bed at, or went home at 9 o'clock there at our time as well. So, and then DJ and I were working during the day. So we got about 3 or 4 hours sleep for 7 or 8 nights in a row. But in that week, we'd managed to secure agreement and then secure the funding, and the contracts were signed on July the 15th, which is a Friday. And I remember being on site with a guy called Brian Butler from Western Power Distribution. And he said, there's absolutely no way on this earth you are going to build a solar park in 2 weeks. And I said to him, I looked him straight in the eye and I said, is that because you can't deliver in time? He said, oh, yeah, we can deliver, no problem. I said, well, you worry about your partnership and I'll worry about mine. And then 10 days later, on July the 28th, he came on site to connect up and he said, I don't know how, but have you gone and built a 5 megawatt solar park in 10 days? And I said, it's because we had to. There was no, what happens if? And then I got that question on site quite a lot of times. What happens if we don't make it? Well, you don't have a job. So keep working. And we did it in spite of everything. We did it. And that was a project to pull together because in 4 weeks, you have to do, you know, fortunately, we managed to find a transformer that GE had that they'd been let down on. And there was lots of things like that happened. And everything just clicked into place. So there was a lot of luck as well, because you know, it's almost impossible even now to pull a solar park together, even as small as 5 megawatts nowadays, in a month and get it fully funded. So that's probably one of my greatest achievements.
Fantastic. A lot of people, the things we need to do a whole series to cover all our stories, but there's a lot of people tune into this podcast because they want to know about your time at Wersol. And we're starting a new gold rush now, and the new gold rush is going to be so mental because, can I even say that? It's going to be insane, the new gold rush, because we're talking about 300 megawatts to gigawatt scale projects. Yeah. And we haven't got anywhere near the people we had before. And I came across you when I took my first holiday in years, managed to secure some cash flows and, you know, started to grow my own business. And I thought I deserved a holiday. So I went to California for the first time and I was on a beach and I was getting panicky phone calls from a chap called Paul Richmond and emails late in the evening. And he wanted to place orders for Wersol in an extreme panic. And we managed to sort the orders out. Why would I say no to money? Even on a beach, you take the orders. Mm. And then I come back jet lagged from California, and the first visit is to come and meet you in Sussex as you're starting at Wersol, and there's all these stretches coming out of everywhere, and we haven't got time, we have to deliver. So comment briefly about the things you can say about your time at Wersol. There's a lot more we need to cover as well, Vince.
Yeah, so basically I joined Wersol in June 2015. Mark I'd known previously when I was at SES, and I just called him up and said, you know, give us a job sort of thing. And he said, what do you want to do? I went, well, you know what, I quite fancy project management. And he said, have you ever done it? I goes, Mark, I've been doing project management since I joined the Navy, because everything you do, no matter, I was in business development for a long time, but sales, business development, whatever it is, you're project managing. You have to maintain contacts with people. You have to let everybody know what's going on, suppliers, clients, whatever, stakeholders. You have to do that. So it's project management is just part of what you do in life, I think. And the funny thing is, I don't have, never have had any project management qualifications, but I was able to deliver on time and in budget. And the only time that I missed it was because the solar park was built, but the high voltage equipment was late turning up by about a week and a half, so we missed the cutoff. So my time in Warsaw was really quite, it was frenetic, because as you well know, you get funding around about October time, October, November, and you've got to build everything by March the 31st. And Mark was the MD at Warsaw, and he was very, very, I wouldn't say gung-ho, but he did have that attitude of, right, we've got this, how are we going to deliver it? And I was the one that was, how are we going to deliver it? And we did. You know, there was one time we had 8 projects on the go, and we delivered it. And it was frenetic. It was fun. It was, you know, it was about building relationships. And I probably built more relationships in that period of time than I have done in most of my career. You know, Warsaw was a great experience.
It's how intensely you live sometimes. It's how intensely you live sometimes. Unfortunately, we had a good reputation. And Paul Richmond or yourself would be phoning me and saying, can you deliver so and so and so? I said, no, we can't. We're full. Oh, by the way, we've sent a 600 grand payment. All right, we'll deliver then. and so it was a crazy intense period, and a lot of it's still not unpacked. I've got Google Maps of the places I've been and the projects we've delivered to. But it wasn't without its challenges. But even then, compared to what we've gone through with the COVID and Ukraine energy crisis and people just going missing from the industry, it was a good time. And now we get to challenges in the industry. What were some of the significant challenges you faced while working in solar or still working in solar and batteries, and how do you think we can overcome them?
Well, I think over time the biggest challenge was the cutoff date of March the 31st. I mean, which idiot chose the end of winter to have a feed-in tariff drop? And that was always a challenge, because, like I said, nobody made decisions during the summer, and it was always a late start. And you know, many a time I've been on a solar site and up to my knees deep in mud. In fact, at one time, I remember we were connecting a project up in Worcestershire, and Steve Ford, who you mentioned earlier, was walking around the solar park. Thankfully, he had his waders on, the things that fishermen wear, so they can go waist high into or chest high into a river. And he literally walked on this bit of mud, and it cracked below him, and he fell up to his chest, and they had to get a telehandler to lift him out. So that was over the time. That was one of the challenges. But now I think the biggest challenge is grid connections. There's no grid connections anymore, and you know, you've got to wait until 2032 plus if you can get one. And even though they're reinforcing the grid, most of that capacity is already gone. It's just madness. And one of the things, you know, in forward looking is that there needs to be somebody who's a responsible adult in government to make decisions, because nobody's really thinking about it. They've got this net zero, and they want the banning cars, sale of ICE and diesel cars by 2030, but they're estimating that there's going to be 8 or 9 million EVs by 2030, but there's no capacity. And you know, I had an electric vehicle 2.5 years ago, and I had to hand it back because I did a day trip, an overnight trip to Hull to go and visit a site, and in that period I was on the road for 22 hours, 9 of it which was actually traveling, the rest of it was looking for a charging point, getting to a charging point and finding that it was broken, or that there was 16 people waiting for that one of the two chargers, or that it was charging at 4.3 rather than 50 kilowatts, and all of these kind of issues. And I just, you know, when I got back from that trip, I thought, thankfully I had my car on a subscription service, And I just thought, no way that, you know, until the infrastructure's there, it's just not viable. And I think that's one of the biggest problems is the, you know, the government saying go electric, but there's nothing on the grid. There's no capacity. And I think that's where battery storage comes into its own. You know, that battery storage at the moment is being put in on the grid, and it's there to flex the grid, and that's great. It does a great job of doing that. But there are so many business out there who are suffering from high energy costs, grid constraints. You know, manufacturers, steelworks, that they've got very high energy costs, but also they can't expand their business because they've got grid constraints, or they're having to go back to diesel generators to you know, give them the extra capacity to expand their business so they can put in a cement work or do something else. And so I think the answer to me is what I would call a microgrid. You know, for companies to install their microgrid, and it starts off with a battery. You install the battery, you charge it up overnight, you deliver it during the day, and hopefully you've got enough grid potential to download for 6 hours. But the average price of electricity between 12 and 6 is around about 4 or 5p, whereas some of these companies are paying the K rates, which are 25-30p per kilowatt hour, or they're breaching their grid capacity agreement and going over capacity. And if you're in the red zone, I believe it's something like £12 per kilowatt hour. It's phenomenal. And so battery storage would be a very good fix. And that's what I'm kind of working on at the moment is how to use battery storage in a clever way and solving problems. Because I think one of the things that solar hasn't really done is solve problems. It's just been, well, let's plug it into the grid and get some money from it. But now I think it's coming into its own with battery storage. But I think battery storage is going to be the driver for the next phase of solar. And I see the future of solar, which links in very nicely with the title of this podcast, as being, if you like, a hybrid where, let's say you put in a battery and put solar on the roof. But that then leaves the door open for if you want to plug in anaerobic digestion or wind turbines or pretty much any other energy source, it can go into this microgrid and it's being fed from everywhere else. And in time, hopefully, that will remove the capacity from the grid so that you're not needing it either as much or at all. And you have, you're fairly self-sufficient. You want to expand? Put up get some planning and put up a new wind turbine, or let's do something else, or let's get a private wire. There's a solar park across the road. We'll get a private wire from them, but that can fit into our system, and that's how I see it going. That and community energy, where you know all the houses and all the industrial units in an area have all got solar on. It's all going into a communal pot, if you like, a communal storage. And if you're producing at the moment on your home, you're getting paid peanuts, and yet it's still costing you 25p per kilowatt hour to buy it back from the grid. Whereas I think the fairer idea is with these community schemes is you're generating it and you're putting it into the pot that gives you credit of, let's say you put in, I don't know, in a year you've put in 1.5 megawatt hours. You're credited with that 1.5 megawatt hours. You can draw it back at any time you want, and once you go over that limit, you then pay, let's say, 10p a kilowatt hour rather than 25p a kilowatt hour, and in that mix, you've got battery storage, you've got solar on everybody's roof, you've got wind turbines, you've got anaerobic digesters, you've got all the different kinds of small scale stuff that you can have in a community. And it's all feeding everybody else. So it really genuinely everybody has an investment into their local area, and everybody has a benefit from it. That's my view anyway. That's my vision. That's where I would like to see it go. I don't know whether it's going to go that way.
Vince, you're a very senior commercial person. You're commercially very astute, but we mustn't forget, you know, you've been in nuclear submarines. You know electrical engineering, and you know a lot about the development side of things financially. If you look at it from a layman's point of view, You know, pubs are closing their doors because they can't afford the energy. Factories are shutting down. Steel plants are closing because of net zero. There seems to be complete failure in regulation from the government. You know, I've spoken to taxi drivers in London. They're saying they can't fund their EV because the finance payments are too much. The interest rates are going up and the charging is going up in some places up to 50 or 80 pence a kilowatt hour, which seems absolutely maddening for me. And you've got these aggregates, you've got these steel plants, and their headspace is already fried. And they've got issued these penalties for consuming energy from the grid at the wrong time. Who funds the development for putting these microgrids in place and upgrading the switchboards and the infrastructure that they might already have? Who pays for all of this development work at a smaller scale where there's a crisis of energy for heavy industry users?
Well, if I look at what we're doing at the moment, I'm working with a company based in Newcastle, actually, who they trade energy, but they also put in battery storage. They also do they don't do the planning. That's one of the roles I'm looking at discussing with them. But so effectively, if one of these companies, let's just say AN Aggregates, once has got a problem on one of their sites, and they want to have this microgrid. We go in there, we assess what the energy use is, and more importantly, when the energy use is, so that, you know, even if we can't supply the whole of the energy for the whole day from a battery because of the grid, we can at least supply them enough capacity to overcome the startup, the inrush currents, and you know, the peak demands, so that they're not getting penalized. That in itself could pay for the battery itself. But a lot of these companies, because they're paying high energy prices, you know, if you look at the manufacturing industries or the aggregate industries, their margins aren't huge. They obviously play on volume, but you know, if you're running your business at 10-12% margin, and the energy price used to be 6% of your total cost, and now it's 10% or 12%. That means you've either got to put your prices up, which isn't going to be popular, or you have to knock it on the chin, and then you run the risk of you're not making enough margin to actually be operational. And so I think that's a big issue. And so what we and you know, based on that, they're probably not going to get funding for it. So what we would do is, working with these guys, is we come in, we assess everything for them, and then we design a system for them, and based on the system design, we would say to them, okay, we can do this, we can put the battery storage in, we can put solar on the roof, and we will deliver you energy at x pounds per megawatt hour, x pence per kilowatt hour, and hopefully that's going to be a lot less than what they're paying at the moment. You know, we're looking at a benchmark of between 10 and 12 p per kilowatt hour, but a lot of that depends on the circumstances in their own situation. If there's a lot of work to do, then it's going to be a little bit more, but hopefully it's going to be a lot less than what they're paying. But the beauty about this is the investors who are behind it are actually able to give price stability for up to 30 years. Typically, it's a 10-year rolling contract because batteries have a 10-year life, and so they'll be looking to renew every 10 years. So, but they could still have a rolling contract for those 10 years with a known cost for those 10 years. And for some businesses, that's imperative. It allows them to forecast. It allows them to budget. It allows them to know what their costs are going to be fairly accurately for quite some distance in the future.
You said in the notes that it's just very difficult to find decent grid connections available for the next few years, even though National Grid are reinforcing their network. You said that there's people getting fined £1 million a year for breaching their demand capacity. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's if you go over your... let's say you've got a 1 megawatt connection, and let's say that your base load is 500 kilowatts per hour. So your 1 megawatt grid connection is fine for that. But when you start up all your machinery, if you've got lots of rotating machinery, you have inrush currents, and they can be three or four times the the base load. So potentially you could be, you know, drawing down for half an hour or an hour, something like 400 kilowatts over your agreed capacity. And the problem there is if you're doing it during the peak time, so if you're starting up at 7 o'clock, that's actually a peak time, you're in the red zone. So you're paying £12 per kilowatt hour that you use during that period. Plus you're getting fined, an additional fine on top of that. So in this one instance, that example that you mentioned, they're getting fined around about £1 million a year just for breaching their contract. That, so if you put a battery storage in just to you know, cope with that initial inrush, and that would be probably about a 1 megawatt battery, 1 megawatt hour battery, that would save them £1 million a year. It would pay for itself in, you know, less than a year, well, half a year. It's a no brainer. And this is what I mean by the penalties. The penalties on the grid are getting higher and higher. But worse still is that now a lot of the grid operators, because they're getting very, very close to the thermal runaway currents, they're actually stopping companies from going over. They're just saying, no, you can't have it. If you go over, we'll stop you. We'll cut you off. And that's probably even more potentially damaging to a business, because, you know, if you're starting up and then all of a sudden your machinery goes off, then that's a big problem for you, because you've got to start all again from scratch, and or you've got a slow start, and that can take 2 hours rather than 40 minutes or so.
Fantastic. This podcast started off as a bit of fun between myself and Mr. Matthew Zanakis from JS Solar. He comes from Zimbabwe. He taught me something very fascinating, which is anyone with the name Kiss in the end is from the island of Crete, famous for Zeus. So to more light-hearted subjects, you know, we need to come back to these heavy topics, the problems, the crisis that's been faced by small and medium-sized businesses. Hopefully we can find a way out of it. Hopefully you're still in touch with Mr. Mark Hogan, who is a very well-respected and senior figure. I believe he started Boom, and more lightheartedly, you own a pub, I guess, with your brother. And, you know, as we meet up in this pub in the future, are you able to tell us how you think the future of the battery and solar technologies can evolve? You know, we've got precious metals in these batteries that could be toxifying landscapes during mining. How do you see the future of precious metals and the compounds and the alloys we might need for all the solar and battery technology?
Well, there's obviously new technology coming out. And I believe Tesla announced last week sometime. And for the life of me, I can't remember the name of the battery technology, but it's lithium something. And it gets rid of the magnesium, the cobalt, and the nickel. And it charges, the energy density is higher, and it's Elon Musk announced that on one full charge he replaced the battery in a typical Tesla, and instead of going 310 miles it went 730 miles, so it's more than double the energy density. So I think and that's just today. In 2 years' time, you know, battery technology comes on in fits and starts, but when it goes big time. And there's other technologies out there. You know, perovskite. They're developing that into such that the efficiency of solar panels will go up with that. And that's going to have a big impact, because I think at the moment the theoretical maximum of a solar panel with monocrystalline is, off the top of my head, around about 30%. I can't remember the exact figure, but it's around about 30%, whereas perovskite is a lot higher, approaching 45-50%. So that's going to make a difference, because, you know, with the same size field you can get in 50% more, so you can get more power out. But we still have the issue with the grid, of course. And then that comes down to different storage technologies, battery or you know, dare I say it, hydrogen. And at the moment, hydrogen isn't ultimately viable, because to convert 1 kilowatt of electricity into hydrogen, you lose 30% on the input and output. But there are other technologies out there that are doing electrolysis in a different way. So I think the answer to your question is, at the moment, we're not in a situation where that's readily available and readily fundable. But then solar, when I first came to the UK in 2010, wasn't fundable in the UK. And now it's like, it's probably one of the most bankable technologies in renewable energy. Yeah, you want to build a solar park? No problem. We'll fund it. How much do you need? And so I think these advances, they're coming. And when you get somebody like Tesla, and I believe Ford, Volkswagen, and there's about 7 or 8 other manufacturers are vying for position for this new technology. They're all trying to sign contracts with the developers and the manufacturers of it. So I think there's a lot of new stuff that's being developed right now, and we're probably about 2 or 3 years from it being, you know, mainstream. But a lot of the projects that are in development in the UK now are 27, 28. So by the time we come round, a 400 megawatt battery storage site now is going to be lithium iron, but in 4 years' time, it might be a third of the size, and it might be twice the amount of energy output.
Fantastic. As Jyoti said on an earlier podcast, solar and wind in the UK are a perfect marriage, because when the wind's blowing, usually the sun's not shining as much. Absolutely. And even the rain is cleaning our modules. So it seems like we're definitely not short on solar panels. The world's installed more than a terawatt peak of solar. Prices are reaching 10 cents a watt, which is maddening to even comprehend. It hasn't sunk in with a lot of people. So we're not short on solar panels, we're short on people. And as we come towards the end of this podcast and we try to conclude, what kind of people do you want to work with, and what is your message to your listeners?
I've had a fair bit of fun in my life in solar, and it's because I like to work with people who really know their onions, or even if they don't, they're willing to knuckle down and learn. When I first started with Wersol, and when we transitioned from Wersol to Boom, I suggested to Mark very strongly that we develop our own projects. And eventually, after much cajoling, Boom Power are now they're now developing. That's their primary model. They are going to be building as well, but the primary model at the moment is development. And I think one of the things I loved about Wersol was that the people within Wersol, we only had 12, 13 people, but everybody knew what they were meant to do, and everybody would help each other out. It wasn't a case of, well, I'm procurement, and I had 4 or 5 different hats on, but, when I first started, I'm project management, and, oh, well, I can't help with procurement. That's nothing to do with me. No, there was only, as you said, Paul Richards. And he needed help, so I moved in. And then when Wersol became Boom and we were going to be doing development, nobody in that team had any knowledge at all about building a solar park, let alone developing it. And we all sat down and we thought, okay, how are we going to do this? We muddled through it. We looked at how it had to be done, and we built the process. And I think Boom Power is probably one of the best developers in terms of their documentation that I've seen, and it's all down to a lady called Sarah. Sarah is absolutely magic. She is so diligent, and then you look at Ed, who when he joined Boom Power, or actually joined Wersol, he was just out of university. He'd had a couple of jobs in bars and stuff, but he came on board, and he was willing to learn. And he was put under my wing, and he learned how to develop. And now he's one of the development team in Boom Power, loving it. And then there's Sam Smith, who was in procurement. He was Paul Richards' underling. And when Paul left, I took over Paul's role, and Sam was under me, and he was keen to learn. He learned. And now he's gone from being procurement to design. He's learned how to design. And I love that idea that, there's, as Mark Hogan says, it's lovely to have the grey-haired people like me and you and Andrew, Andrew's the accountant, who have a safe pair of hands, who've got the knowledge, who know what they're doing. But it's also great to have fresh ideas, fresh people coming in, because I don't know it all. And I will learn from, Sam Smith was, I think he was 17 when he joined Wersol. I think he's 24, 25 now. But how many 24, 25-year-olds are in charge of a procurement department in a fairly major developer? And I love that idea that there's a mix of fresh talent who come through who are willing to learn. That for me, every day I learn something new, and I will learn from anybody. Even a 3-year-old child can show you something that you maybe forgotten or didn't know. And you have to be open to learning. So when I work with people, I want to work with people who are that open-minded, open communication, and just have that attitude of, let's see how we're going to do this and let's get the job done. I love that spirit of, if you like, the pioneering spirit. Yeah, we've got this project. How we're going to build it? We'll work it out. Don't worry. Let's just take it on. That's the kind of people I want to work with.
It's the environment that you create. I mentioned Soul Century a lot, probably Wersol not enough. And to me, yourself and people like Ben Hogan and Steve Ford and Ian Fudge are Wersol. And because there's lack of toxicity, people enjoy visiting you when you would need any little thing or even a general conversation about new inverters or whatever. We would look forward to coming and seeing you in Sussex, and that will be the highlight of our day. And we'll go for a nice pub lunch, and I've noticed, people, very junior people joined you, like Rizwan, Harry Finnegan, they went on to become very senior people in their fields. Rizwan's a CTO at Huawei, Harry's a very big manager in StatCraft, and so that's what seems to be missing on certain other environments. When there is blame culture and toxicity, you tend to have people arguing, but your magic ingredient seems to be the positive environment you tend to nurture. And I certainly have enjoyed working with you. I've enjoyed listening to you on this podcast, and I hope to listen back and reflect on some of the things you've said and have you back on in the very near future.
Absolutely. And maybe next time I will play the guitar and sing.
Fantastic, Vince. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Vikram. It's been an absolute pleasure as always.
You have been listening to the Future of Solar podcast with Vikram Kumar. Thank you very much for listening.